We have fun topics today, actually. There's been a lot going on with religion and politics, and we are going to be discussing Michelle Bachmann and Rick Perry and mostly all the other ways that religion is making itself known in the Republican race for the nomination. I'm Amy Sullivan, and I'm a contributing writer at Time Magazine.
And I'm Sarah Pulliam Bailey. I'm online editor for Christianity Today, and I also write for GetReligion.org.
And let's just go straight off into the latest Republican debate in Iowa. It's kind of amusing to me that this has been the question that everybody kind of jumped on from the debate, but Michelle Bachmann was asked by Byron York in the debate about whether she would be submissive to her husband as president. What did you think from that question? Because it's certainly stirring up a lot of people, and particularly liberals who found it a very sexist question.
Sure. I thought it was funny slash interesting slash annoying, you know, all these things. So here's the thing. I think Michelle Bachmann kind of set it up so that, you know, he's not asking this question out of nowhere, right? Like, she talked about this in a 2006 speech when she said she wasn't really interested in tax law, but her husband suggested it as an idea. And she's like, you know, wives, be submissive to your husbands. And, I mean, this is set in a context of she's talking to evangelicals. And so they understand where this is coming from. So this question is not coming from nowhere, but at the same time, it's a little bit like, really, are we really talking about this with all the things going on in the world? So, so I thought her answer was pretty interesting. I don't know if you have that right in front of you, but she said, you know, it was, her answer was, it means respect for each other. And I thought that was interesting because there are a lot of different beliefs about how wives should be submissive to their husbands, how that manifests itself within, you know, the biblical context or whatever. So it was interesting to hear her response, but I think it doesn't tell us still much about, you know, how it plays out in their lives together. So what did you think, Amy?
Well, the first thing I did was kind of flash back to divinity school and try to remember. I know I did a paper not on submission, but on the verse about wives or women being weaker and kind of looked through some of the old translations. I'm forgetting the exact German word right now, but I went back to a Luther translation that actually the word was kind of a softer, and not in a weak sense, but in kind of a gentler sense, which I found interesting and kind of made me wish that I'd looked into the submission verses as well.
I'm sure, you know, in the coming days, we'll see lots of articles on what, you know, submission and what that means. And I'm sure this will be picked apart.
We should just say, and I felt like this about Frances Schaeffer, who we'll get to later, that it's kind of amazing to me that in the middle of a presidential campaign, we have political reporters, you know, trying to talk about the writings and thought of Frances Schaeffer and realizing that such a thing as submission theology exists.
Right.
So that's kind of a weird reality. But back to the question, I thought it was totally reasonable. Again, as you say, she's brought it up before, and we don't really know how that plays out in their lives. And it could just be we're evangelical Christians, and so, of course, you know, we kind of think that we should submit to each other and respect each other. But, you know, there is a much, more orthodox view of submission that would be extremely relevant if she was going to be president of the United States. And so I thought it was worth getting into. What I thought would have been sexist, and that's what most people have kind of jumped on this question as, is how dare they ask her, would they ask Newt Gingrich the same thing? you know, a lot of people talked in 2008 about the fact that Todd Palin seems to have been such a close advisor to Sarah Palin, and not even so much in an advisory role, but in kind of an enforcer role, and using her name to go directly to people and tell them to do things. When she got questions about that, I thought that definitely was sexist, because we've certainly seen political wives who've been very involved in their husbands' careers and almost never do the husbands get questioned about that. So that seemed an instance where it was a question they wouldn't ask of a man, and that I think should be the test here. Again, this was something that she had brought up, and it is more of an issue for wives in you know, conservative evangelical marriages than it would be for men. So I thought that was legit. But again, I guess the biggest takeaway I got was just the uproar on Twitter when that happened, of liberals having no idea what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. And at the time, and I should say I didn't watch live, so I wasn't sure what the question was immediately. I thought that Byron New York had just asked out of the blue, would you be submissive to your husband if you were president? But he actually provided quite a bit of the context there, and people still, I think, weren't aware of what he was talking about in an evangelical context. But the crowd, it should be noted, in the auditorium, booed the question and was also very upset. So they were clearly thinking that it was a an out-of-bounds question.
Sure.
And shouldn't have been asked by her.
And as much as I think, okay, I think maybe one question is appropriate, but I hope that just is done, and I hope we're done with that for a while, because
yeah.
I don't see it as a central point. I mean, we've seen her govern as a congresswoman. We've seen how they interact as a couple. I think it's fair to throw out, you know, one question early on in the campaign, whatever, but I don't know. Do you think we need to know more about this, or do you think we're done here? In terms of that question.
I think
question.
We're going to hear more, not in terms of that specific question, but in terms of what her theology actually is, particularly, which we'll get into in a second, but, mm-hmm. You know, the influence of dominionist writers and thinkers. I think, again, that's fair, because that would go directly to what she saw her responsibility as head of the country. But we're also going to get into this just weird land where people are suddenly discovering conservative evangelicals and what they think. And, you know, they may have thought we got there with George W. Bush, and we really didn't at all.
Right. I mean, I'm interested in just this whole gender divide. You know, Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann running as evangelical women is very interesting, you know,
yeah.
with the whole theology about not just in marriage, but also in leadership and church leadership, and then how that
yeah.
plays out just in work roles between the husband and wife. So it's interesting, but
yeah,
I hope
well,
we...
among...
Go ahead.
Right. Well, you raised the question of how do we get into these interesting issues that we'd like to hear more about without it becoming a total sideshow
mm-hmm.
And a circus. And I don't know. Because to me, this question was kind of the evangelical equivalent of asking Mitt Romney about Mormon underwear.
Right.
You know,
that's a good point. That's a good...
Kind of not something that we want to be getting into. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I suppose you could argue, and I would argue, that it was more relevant than a Mormon underwear question. You know, you talk about women and evangelicals. I think it is interesting to ask how she'll be received by conservative evangelicals when they actually have to think about voting.
Right.
Obviously,
that'll
she's
be very
popular.
Sure.
But, you know, if people belong to a denomination where women aren't allowed to hold leadership positions and, you know, can't stand behind the pulpit, you know, how does that translate into how they look at a woman and think about putting her in the Oval Office?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. And I know... towards the end of our conversation, we want to get into, will evangelicals support, you know, someone like Bachmann who they might identify with, and then versus Rick Perry versus Tim Pawlenty. You know, there are all these potential candidates they could vote for. So I know you want to touch on that too.
Yeah. Well, why don't we move next, because I know you have very strong feelings about this, to the Ryan Lizza piece in The New Yorker that came out this week, which, again, as we said, provided the bizarre situation of having Francis Schaeffer's plot discussed and debated throughout the political press corps this week, as well as the Newsweek story, which has kind of gotten overshadowed by the cover.
Right, right. I wanted to ask you, I mean,
about whether that was
what
fair.
Did you think of that cover and the picture, you know, all that?
I was torn, honestly. It's been a pet peeve of mine for a while, the way that women, and particularly older women politicians, are often photographed. Mm-hmm. Before I started at Time, I went through a lot of back issues just to get a sense of their coverage. Not to pick on my employer here, but they've never put Nancy Pelosi on the cover, but they did a big spread on her when she became Speaker of the House. And it was two black and white photos across two pages, full photos. And they were the most unflattering, just awful pictures. I mean, they were so close up in such detail that you could see how fine her hair looked. She just looked like a 90-year-old woman. And you got every wrinkle in her face. Her eyes kind of do have that Michelle Bachmann, like, wide-open look. And it was just awful. And that was one thing I vowed to myself for my short tenure as Nation editor, was that I would not let photos like that of women mm-hmm. get mm-hmm. into the magazine. And it was tested when Hillary Clinton was running.
Sure.
Because obviously we wanted to run a lot of Hillary photos. And at one point we had a similar situation where it was actually of her campaigning in Iowa, and we were going to do a four-picture spread. And so many of the pictures, she just had this crazy look on her face. And I think, you know, it would happen with any of us mm-hmm. if you were to take
yeah.
pictures
sure.
and we're trying to, like, feign enthusiasm and do a big smile with people we've never met before. But it was really hard to go through the pictures and not end up with a gallery that was just going to look like we were mocking her.
Uh-huh.
So I would say I feel some sympathy, except that there must have been a picture that they had. You know, I know the Newsweek folks are saying, well, she looks like this in every picture. But
well, did you see the gallery that they released of the other photos?
Yeah.
Okay. I felt like there were definitely other ones that would have captured, if you had to go with the Queen of Rage headline, the headline that went with this photo was the Queen of Rage. There were other photos that captured that without making her look like just absolutely nuts. I felt like it
in
did
fact,
not,
had
that's
a
not
quiet
the Michelle
photo
of her. Bachmann that I see on TV or that, you know, it didn't feel like mm-hmm. the same, you know, person who's running for president. I don't know. But I thought it was interesting that they spun the article. I don't know if you read the deck. You know, mm-hmm. it's Bachmann on God, the Tea Party, and Evils of Government. I thought what was interesting, I ended up, you know, reading the article. It wasn't very long. It barely touches on faith. Like, they sell the cover with God after the Queen of Rage and then that crazy photo, but the article really didn't touch on her faith very much. So I was a little bit surprised that, you know, they're selling it this way, and the article itself hardly has anything about her views on God. So.
Oh, but Sarah, putting God on the cover of a Newsweekly is not surprising.
No, it's not surprising. I'm just saying I felt like it was a way to sell it, but then the article was kind of like, oh, well, that's...
Didn't get into
right.
it. Yeah, and there was plenty of material, as we saw in Ryan Lizza's piece.
Right, and yeah.
So do you want to kind of walk us through your response to that?
Sure.
Because you certainly had strong feelings about
it. I did. I called it a smear, and I... at getreligion.org, and I don't know if I would use the same strong word that I did a couple days ago when I first read it. I was just appalled, but I think there were a couple things that frustrated me And one was just his word choice and the way he painted her out to be kind of a fringe lunatic, and then the people that she draws from or that she has been associated with, again, painting them as sort of fringe. And then we talked a little bit about this man named Francis Schaeffer, who she has been influenced by, and she cites as, you know, someone she's read. And I felt like the piece didn't quite accurately portray what he was saying. So, and then you can kind of tell in the piece some of the, like, he's like, she tried to evangelize. I don't remember the language that he used, but it was like, oh my goodness, she tried to evangelize people in college. And then her foster, as a foster parent, she, you know, felt like this was a good way to, you know, possibly help them become a Christian or whatever. Well, that's not exactly shocking if you know, you know, evangelicals, like that's part of being an evangelical. So I felt like he kind of came at it from a not that familiar with evangelicals perspective. There were a couple of weird connections that I felt like, with two in particular that I wanted to point out. I felt like, so he brought up the views of somebody who wrote for her law school's law review. So this is, she went to Oral Roberts Law School. It's no longer there, but it's transferred over to Regent, which is where Pat Robertson does his thing over. So this man who's written for her law school's law review has some interesting views, to say the least, about government. And, you know, and Ryan brings up these, this man and his piece as sort of like just a brief, it's not like a central point, but it's like, okay, so are we going to do this, you know, for President Obama and where he went to law school and somebody who wrote for his law review? I mean, I know it's not quite a direct comparison because you're trying to get a sense of, or Roberts as a, you know, this former school, but at the same time, it was like, okay, were they connected in any way? Has Bachman ever said that she adheres to his views? There was just no, like, connection to me for that individual. And then the second person who he threw in as an example, which is kind of odd to me, was this Minnesota politician, Republican, who he uses a quote about how they purge people who have certain views about abortion and hit people who are vegetables. And so some strange views, but there's no indication to me that Bachman is, you know, maybe who knows if she even met this man. And so it seemed like Ryan was throwing in just a few people and not really showing a direct connection between their beliefs and Bachman's beliefs.
Can I jump in there please, for a second, just to respond to a couple of those. I want to go back to the mention of her foster kids, because sure. I really did think that was unfair.
Okay.
Just to summarize for people who haven't read the piece, there's a short couple paragraphs, I guess, about her role as a foster parent. They've had 23 foster daughters, many of whom had eating disorders, and it seems like the Bachman specifically requested girls with eating disorders to be able to help them with that. And my sense is, if you are having foster kids to proselytize to them and try to save them, you wouldn't specifically look for girls with eating disorders. That, to me, speaks of people who are looking to help folks. But the second thing is just, it's hard being a foster parent. Like, nobody, even the most hardcore evangelical, is going to do that just in order to save people.
Right.
I do believe that was probably an interest of hers once the girls were in their household, was sharing her faith, as you point out. That's what evangelicals do. But I don't think anybody has 23 foster kids purely because they're looking to proselytize and save more people. And that was kind of the implication I got from that description. So I thought that was unfair. As for the examples you mentioned, The first one I actually thought was a way of just trying to give readers a sense of what Oral Roberts Law School is like and the types of views that they give a platform to. I didn't see that as a case where Ryan was trying to tie her to this man's thought. He probably could have made that more clear, but I thought that was a fair one. And on the second one, I'll just say I was somewhat confused because I thought the Minnesota Republican was presented as somebody who felt he'd been wronged by Bachman and other politicians, kind of her more right-wing ideology. But I was very confused about the way that he was used and what we were supposed to draw from.
Yeah, I think that's what I kind of took away from the piece. And maybe what you said about, you know, this Professor Oral Roberts, like if he had said, if Ryan had said, like, this is an example of the people at Oral Roberts, I might have been like, oh, okay. But I felt like he kind of threw it in there and didn't really tell us what we're supposed to think about that, like you said. And I felt like that was a big, you know, I mean, this is a really lengthy piece. It's not like a 500-word blip where he doesn't have time to explain quite everything. I felt like he could flesh it out a little bit more and say, okay, why am I including this? Because, I mean, when we talk about these other, say, another private law school, I don't know if we would pick on, you know, somebody with, I mean, is this professor, is he someone who, you know, was a prominent professor who, you know, like, this is a regular way of thinking there, or was he just, like, happened to be one of many who got published in this law review and said some crazy, you know, things or whatever? That was what I was unclear was whether, you know, how much of an influence he was at Oral Roberts, or if he was just a contributor.
That's fair. Yeah. You know, if he certainly was somebody whose views would have been considered extreme or unusual, we would have needed to know that. Which probably brings us pretty well to Frances Schaefer, because I, as well, was very surprised to see him described as fringe and exotic. You know, I do think the vast majority of Christians, maybe not vast, but Christians in general, if you're a mainline Protestant, if you're Catholic, you probably have not heard of Frances Schaefer, and many evangelicals have not heard of Frances Schaefer. That said, he was a really prominent evangelical, and his films really did shape the modern Christian right movement. But not just as a political force, they really shaped how evangelicals thought about themselves and their place in the world. And so this is definitely not somebody who would have been unfamiliar to a lot of evangelicals in the 70s and 80s and even now. And I didn't think that he was presented in a way that would have given you an accurate representation of who he was, especially with Ryan talking to his son, who he mentioned had left evangelicalism. But as you know, it's so much more than that. He has kind of rejected it in a very public way and now spends a lot of his time going after the religious right. And so to use him as kind of an objective source to walk you through Schaefer's thought and what he was trying to do, I thought really shouldn't have been done without noting where his thoughts and leanings lie now.
Sure. I mean, you know, it's not unusual that he might draw on his son for at least a resource, but it seemed like that was his main source, you know, for describing the video that, you know, a video that Frances Schaefer made and things like that. I mean, there are several other people who could have given him another perspective. Chuck Colson, Ron Sider, Mark Knoll, he's influenced so many evangelicals who could give him a perspective from, you know, for what he did, getting evangelicals really interested in abortion. I mean, at first, evangelicals kind of saw it as a more Catholic issue, and then, you know, he personally helped Jerry Falwell get interested in the issue, and Jerry Falwell didn't, I believe he didn't preach on it until 1978, and Roe v. Wade passed in 1973. So this is a couple of years that it takes him to get evangelicals interested in this as an issue. So, and just some of the things that Ryan, the way he wrote the arguments that Francis Schaeffer made, like he said that Francis Schaeffer argues for the violent overthrow of the government if Roe v. Wade isn't reversed, which if you look at the things that Francis Schaeffer has written, he said almost exactly the opposite, that violence is not, he said, overreaction can too easily become the ugly horror of sheer violence. So there, it's clear, you know, that he is taking more of a, you might say a Martin Luther King perspective on what do you do when you disagree with the government, and violence was not one of his main points, so.
Right, yeah, and that's where I also thought this didn't give you a great sense of who Schaeffer was overall, that, you know, some of his writings towards the end of his life did kind of veer off in a different direction, but that definitely was not the meat of his influence and what people would have thought of when they thought of Francis Schaeffer.
Well, the other interesting, you mentioned, you know, his son Frank as a source, but also Sarah Rose Diamond is cited in the piece, and he summarizes her work where she says, Christians and Christians alone are biblically mandated to occupy all secular institutions until Christ returns. So this Sarah Rose Diamond, she wrote a book called Facing the Wrath, Confronting the Right in Dangerous Times. So something about that makes me think that she is not a terribly unbiased source. She may be a source and a good, you know, person to draw on for one perspective, but she's certainly not, you know, like a scholar, you know, coming at it from an objective viewpoint. And what's interesting is that Francis Schaeffer actually says, again, kind of the opposite of that idea. He said, we must not, and this is, I believe, in a Christian Manifesto, he said, we must not confuse the kingdom of God with our country. To say it another way, we should not wrap Christianity in our national flag. So, he, you know, it's kind of like, okay, this is how she's interpreting it. Well, let's look at what Francis Schaeffer actually said. And compare the text. Right. So I felt like Ryan was drawing.
And actually.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just thinking that would have been a fascinating thing to get into is, you know, he obviously has had some influence on Michelle Bachmann, but what parts of his writings have influenced her and what parts, you know, does she clearly seem to conflict with,
sure.
At least in her orientation. That would have been really interesting. We need to move on
sure.
to Perry here. So I just want to kind of sum up that for me, Ryan's article, and, you know, Ryan Lizza is one of the best political reporters and writers out there. But it to me, shows the danger and really the challenge of trying to get into theology if you're a political reporter and how tough it can be.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because I agree with you on all of the ways that he could have kind of delved more deeply into this and gotten a probably broader and more comprehensive view of who Schaeffer was and a lot of the other people he cited. That would have required, I think, a lot more study in evangelicalism than your average reporter has a chance to take, and Ryan, I'm sure, spent months and months on this piece, so he even had significantly more time than most reporters do. So that's something we may come back to, is just kind of, as long as Michelle Bachmann's in the race, people are going to be looking at who her influences are. I think this was an obvious and useful task to undertake, but how can people who don't have a background in theology and familiarity with evangelicalism do this in an accurate and useful way? I just kind of present that as a question. But let's move on to Rick Perry, because we want to talk about his event last weekend, The Response, and kind of look at that, especially as he's about to announce his candidacy. Just kind of what was your take from the response?
And so what did you expect going I should forward? Admit, I did not really watch a ton of it. I was,
It was webcast.
What? Sorry?
It was webcast, all 8 hours.
I know. We don't really have TV. I mean, so anyway, all that to say, what I thought was funny, I was in a store and CNN was, you know, playing or whatever. And they were like, Rick Perry praised for Obama or whatever, which is funny because that was kind of the headline. That was kind of the takeaway at that very moment that I happened to be watching it, which was later in the day. What was funny to me was that actually, it would have been surprising if he hadn't prayed for President Obama, because Christians, you know, there's a direct,
right,
you know, biblical mandate to pray for leaders in office. So, I thought that was kind of funny that they were like, oh my goodness, this is, you know, bipartisan or whatever. But it, you know, is like,
yeah,
no, actually, it's not shocking that he prayed for Obama. So,
yeah.
But anyway, I was kind of torn, you know, when I first read about the plan to do this back in May, I was like, oh, you know, whatever, this is not that big of a deal. I don't know. I just was kind of like, I don't really see why this is such a big deal. So I don't know if you feel differently, if you felt like, no, this really is, you know, something we should be examining and taking apart. What did you think? Were there any surprises either before or after the event?
I guess I'll say as soon as I saw the official website and the invitation from Perry and the language of it, which was calling on his fellow Americans to pray and call upon Jesus to guide them, I thought it was a big deal just because he is governor of Texas, and he's not calling for a broad day of prayer.
Mm-hmm.
He's calling on his fellow citizens to pray to Jesus, which I thought was very different. It didn't strike me as important from a political standpoint in terms of what it said about whether he would run or
mm-hmm.
not, and I still don't. It always seemed to me that it was an apples and oranges argument, because people were raising concerns about the appropriateness of Perry's role in the event, and he would say, well, but it's not political. And that wasn't kind of the point.
Sure.
It's that he can never stop being governor of Texas, mm-hmm. so it's political in a way just because he's involved. But people didn't really care whether this was being used to launch his presidential campaign. That wasn't what their concerns were. But I was kind of surprised. I mean, I knew going in it was going to be Christian-centered and evangelical-centered. But watching it, I saw absolutely no difference between that event and your average evangelical revival. I mean, that's what it was a revival. And, you know, I said at the time, like, there's nothing inherently wrong with a revival at all. And there's nothing wrong with Perry appearing and speaking and praying at a revival. But to have the governor of Texas sponsor a revival and kind of frame it as a national day of repentance and prayer for all Americans, I just found something very uncomfortable with that. And I guess I was surprised that, you know, this was something he supposedly was involved in planning and organizing. And the fact that it never occurred to anybody involved that maybe we should separate his role here, or maybe we should make it a little more inclusive. Maybe it shouldn't surprise me with Texas, but it did.
Sure. I guess for me, because it wasn't a taxpayer-funded event, and because really other organizations were heading it up, you know, kind of doing the groundwork. To me, it says something more about, okay, so Rick Perry, you know, maybe he'll, what will this mean, you know, if he becomes president, you know, how will this play, you know, will you try to do similar events on the weekends? I don't know. You know, it's kind of like, you know, maybe you might, people, voters might see it as not prudent, but I don't know if there was like a constitutional issue in that, you know, that whole separation of church and state, because it seemed to me that it was more on, even though he can't stop being governor for a day, he can still do things that are particular to one constituency. That's kind of how I saw it, or that was kind of my takeaway, but, you know, maybe there were some blur, you know, because, you know, there was an atheist group that brought this up to a judge, and the judge was like, you know, there's no issues here that the judge saw. So, I, you know, in terms of constitutionality, I didn't necessarily see an issue. Was it, whether it was smart politically, he got so much attention and so much confusion around that event that I just wondered whether that was a smart move for him. I don't know. Maybe he loves the press no matter what, but you know, in terms of good or bad coverage, but it just ended up being more scrutiny than I thought, you know, was either warranted or, you know, it just was a very weird event in general. How it was executed, who was behind it, and then what that says about Perry.
Right. Well, one of the kind of longstanding lessons of political coverage that most candidates know is that it very rarely matters what you say if you have good pictures mm-hmm. to go along with it. There was a famous story of, I think it was an NBC report on Reagan that was very critical. But the footage that they were playing in the background as the voiceover was saying these critical things was fantastic from the Reagan campaign's point of view. And so they were thrilled with the segment, even though, you know, if you listened to it, it wasn't great for their candidate. But they thought if you were just watching, and that's what affects most people, that you came away with the idea that Reagan was this very strong leader. And I kind of feel that way about this with Rick Perry. Somebody mentioned that the point of the event could have been just to say, I'm not Mormon. I'm really, 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 really Christian. And, you know, if you think that he's going to be kind of a co-front runner battling it out with Mitt Romney for the nomination when he gets into the race, then that's probably a pretty smart thing to do.
Sure.
If most people aren't going to care about the actual substance of the event or whether it was appropriate, all they took away from it was that you are one super Christian-y guy, then that probably works for him, at least in the primaries. I don't think it's a good strategy at all when it comes to trying to win the general election, but, you know, that's probably a bridge too far for him at this point. So I actually need to wrap it
sure.
up.
Yeah.
So we're going to have to do a lightning round
okay.
here with our last question, which is, as it happens, just too big a question to really cover in an hour anyway. So we might as well try to give it our lightning round treatment, which is the question of where we think conservative evangelicals actually will go when it comes time to cast their vote. Obviously, 2008 was an interesting year because you had leaders within the Christian right really split and getting behind half a dozen different candidates. But at the end of the day, people in the pews decided Mike Huckabee was their guy. If he'd had the money and resources, I think he could have gone the distance to really challenge McCain, maybe even take the nomination. But there is no Huckabee candidate this year, in part because there are a lot of people who can lay some claim to being part of the evangelical community. Mm-hmm. So what's your thought? Where do you think it stands right now in terms of who a conservative evangelical would lean towards supporting?
Honestly, it's so hard to tell. Like, if you had asked me a couple weeks ago, I might have said, you know, one person. But, you know, like a couple weeks ago, we saw an interesting poll from the National Association of Evangelicals, the board of that, which is about 100-some leaders. A strong percentage really liked Tim Pawlenty. Well, Tim Pawlenty isn't doing that great just overall. So, you know, at the end of the day, they're going to probably try to find somebody who has you know, who's going to take away the nomination. They're not going to want to support somebody who's not going to end up winning. In my mind, it's kind of between Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann. I don't know why I say that, probably because they're doing well in the polls, and, you know, we've seen polls that suggest that evangelicals are reluctant to vote for someone who's Mormon. So even though Mitt Romney is kind of leading there overall in the polls, among conservative Christians, you may have some trouble. So I don't know. What do you, I mean, I think you raise a good question about the Michelle Bachmann's, just her, you know, being a woman, whether that'll play a factor. If it's up between the two of them, maybe evangelicals will be like, well, you know, I prefer, you know, someone who's a man. I don't know. What do you think? What have you found in your reporting so far?
Well, I will find it really interesting to see how people respond to Michelle Bachmann as a woman. And I honestly haven't done enough reporting on that, but I'd really like to, because my theory is that people were had an easier time thinking about Sarah Palin as a vice presidential candidate, because she kind of had the wife role there.
As a vice presidential candidate?
She was the surrogate, yeah. She was the pastor's wife, you know, standing next to the main guy. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's very familiar to evangelicals. But if it had been flipped, if she was in the top slot, you know, setting aside all questions about her qualifications and just looking at her as a conservative woman, I think there are evangelicals who would have a tough time supporting her for that position. And I think the same thing may apply with Michelle Bachmann. Now, you know, you can't set aside Sarah Palin's qualifications, and you can't set aside some of Michelle Bachmann's beliefs, which were coming out in the debate. It wasn't a matter of her religious beliefs. It was a matter of seeming to not quite understand how the debt ceiling works and how the Standard and Poor's rating works. And, you know, that if we had just refused to do anything with the debt ceiling, that everything would be hunky-dory. That's just factually incorrect. And it's not the first time, nor will it be the last time, that she'll say things like that. And I think that's going to start to trickle in and be something that people kind of have to accommodate to their pre-existing views about Michelle Bachmann, and even maybe their pre-existing excitement about her as someone who can throw out the red meat lines and is down the line, like Rick Perry, I think. You know, not somebody like a John Huntsman, obviously, but not even like Rick or Mike Huckabee, who did try to moderate some of his views, who was kind of a more lenient supporter of immigration reform and who, on economic issues, would talk about economic justice sometimes. You know, Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann are just through and through conservatives and people who excite the base. So I think, you know, I think you're right that it looks like it's a toss-up between them right now in terms of who will excite people. And it may come down to who can win and who, you know, do they want to support as a winner.
Sure.
But we will have plenty of chances to talk more about this. And the good news is that you and I will have plenty of things to write.
Yes, it is. It's going to be a fun year, I think.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this, your first Blogging Heads appearance. Yeah. So we'll would love to have you back and do more of this as the campaign spins
out. Great. Thanks, Amy. Have a good day.
All right.
See ya.
Thank you, Sarah. Take care.
Bye.